Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, it's been about a month since Silicon Valley Bank's collapse created panic across the country. The bank was largely known as a financial backbone to the tech industry, but SVB also has a significant stake in a niche market, wine. For nearly 30 years, Silicon Valley Bank built its wine division with a portfolio of clients, both large and small, that numbered into the hundreds. And the bank's collapse, as well as the financial uncertainty that followed, had ripple effects across California's wine industry, which, no surprise, is the most lucrative in the country and among the top in the world. Silicon Valley Bank has now been acquired by First Citizens Bank, which provides much-needed relief and stability. But for a 101 on what makes the wine industry financially unique, we have invited our very own wine expert, New York Times bestselling author Rick Cushman. Nice to see you again, Rick.
Good morning, Vicky.
Okay, so your knowledge of the wine industry from small to large goes back decades. When you first learned about Silicon Valley Bank's demise, essentially, did your experience shape your initial reaction to the news?
Yeah, I mean, my first reaction was, asterisk. You know, it's, you know, I knew that folks were going to be super nervous and for all kinds of complicated reasons. And that we're saying, you know, agriculture is its own world. And then wine is its own world inside ag. And SVB was really the only bank that understood like all the little vagaries of what makes the wine industry so unique and so tenuous, too.
Yeah. I mean, given that you say that SVB is the bank for the California wine industry, why did that even begin? Why did Silicon Valley Bank begin to carve out this unique wine division nearly 30 years ago back in 1994?
Well, it goes back to one guy, Rob McMillan, who's founded it and has run their division forever and loves wine. And so part of it was him understanding that this was this cool, unique business. And you know, for people can remember back that far, you know, wine was really just starting to grow as a big deal in America back then. But, you know, Napa and Sonoma and the Central Valley and all those places were starting to bloom. But what makes them unique was that they understood all of the vagaries of it. They had specific financial instruments. And by the way, I love saying that word because it makes it sound like I know what I'm talking about, which I don't. You know, that were designed for all of the things that they do. And I mean, we could break it up into small pieces and big pieces. But the large look is, you know, income comes in slow versions, whereas the money goes out in huge chunks. The money doesn't come in for maybe 4 years or 6 years or 8 years, depending on how you do it. If you plant a vineyard, you have to wait 4 years before you even get grapes. And then those grapes have to become wine, which is another 1 to 4 years. You know, meanwhile, you've got all these expenses piling up. And then if you are a different kind of a winery, if you're a winery that, you know, that just buys grapes or buys juice, makes it and sells it, you have one kind of financing. If you're a winery that builds everything, that has its, you know, the vineyards and the wine machines and the tanks and the barrels and the distribution, then you need a different kind of money. And whether it's a long-term loan or lines of credit. And so all of those things are a place to start. And the other part is that they understood wine. They understood what wine was valuable because ultimately that's a big part of their collateral. So if, you know, if somebody doesn't know what the value of a $100 bottle or $200 a bottle a cash of wine versus somebody who's got larger amounts but less value, got to be able to price that too. And so all of that makes them very unique, and they learned it, you know, because of this one person's passion, but also because they could see that it was growing.
So wine grapes, they're part of the broader agricultural industry. Why specifically does the wine industry need a bank like Silicon Valley Bank as opposed to more mainstream financial institutions?
Well, let's just say you're starting up. What makes it a difference? Well, you've got large capital costs. All right. So if you're starting a farm, you also have a large capital cost. You know, but if you're planting an annual crop, you know, than you get at the end of the year. If you're starting a laundromat, you open the doors, you start making money. Not enough, but, you know, and if you've got a restaurant, well, restaurants have their own crazy flows, you know, but then, you know, you've got to build your market. So, you know, all of that stuff is super hard. You know, if you are, you got to buy barrels, but you have to decide what kind of barrels. And then, you know,
And the price can range.
And then you get your grapes. And then, now you got to decide what you're going to do with them, because you think you may be making Cabernet, but then you realize that you need something else. You need to put some Petit Verdot in there. So now you got to go buy that Petit Verdot. Or do you plant it? And then, you know, so you have these expenses that continue to roam. And the money comes in not really at any one point, sometimes in bigger bits and then smaller bits. And so, you know, there's all those sorts of things that make it really more complicated than so many other businesses. You know, and then each kind of wine, like I was saying, each kind of winery is a different animal. You know, a large winery has a different funding need than a small one. If you don't own your vineyards, then you need to buy wine or buy grapes. And so then you have a different need. If you do own your vineyards, well, then you need to care for them. So now you have labor costs that you didn't have otherwise. And each segment of the industry and each size of the industry is part of it. And that's just getting started. And then, you know, from there, it gets more complicated, too.
Yeah, it's kind of like they offered a boutique service to the wine industry. And what I also thought was interesting, it's not just, you know, financial investments, but they also offered kind of like financial advice. They had an annual economic outlook on the state of the U.S. wine industry. How significant was this to supporting their clients?
So that was huge because, you know, if you think about it, the wine business, unlike many businesses, even a restaurant, is so connected to the vagaries of the whole world. You know, the trends in Europe can then affect U.S. wine. The trends in U.S. wine can affect Europe. The amount of bulk wine that's available in Chile might affect the amount of bulk wine that's available in Spain, that might affect the bulk wine that's available in the U.S. So if you're somebody small, you do not have the resources to know that sort of thing. Plus, you don't have the resources to know what consumer trends are, really, especially, you know, if you're one of our friends in the Foothill that sells 2,500 cases a year out of your tasting room, you know, it's hard for you to be able to measure what's going on with consumers, what tastes are changing, you know, where people are going. And so they supply that service. But if you're a big winery and you also have your own your own people, then it's another benchmark. It's a way for you to validate your own numbers to be sure that you're going. And what Rob McMillan did was and then Silicon Valley Bank was, he had two things going. One, they had this cache of information from all of these years dealing with all of these wineries. He had the trust of the industry. So people would tell him things. When he did his surveys, you know, how many surveys do you get from your own employer? Will you give them, not that you would do this, of course, to your employer or me to mine, but other people might, where you give them really quick answers, right? As opposed to really detailed answers. But people gave them detailed answers because they knew the value of this. And then people outside of the industry also trusted them so that then they could get information. So it made it a very unique and a very valuable resource.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned also when we were talking ahead of this segment that there were even people from the bank that would actually like help with production as well.
Yeah, no, I'm sure there are
like
many wineries.
Roll their sleeves up and get a little dirty.
I'm sure there are many wineries that would tell you that this never happened, but there are plenty of the smaller folks who, you know, started with them long ago and who make either good or interesting wine or just stayed involved. And there would be, you know, there's Adam Lee, is a rather famous winemaker in the Sonoma area who created Siduri, which is a great Pinot place, and he later sold it. But he talks about that, you know, he didn't know how to do this. He didn't know how, you know, he went from, this is very typical, he went from custom crush, which is you rent space at another winery and they make your wine. So you either grow your own grapes or buy your own grapes. And in this case, he was choosing his own grapes, and he had, you know, vineyards that he worked with. and then he'd bring it into the custom crush facility and he'd buy them. So he has a certain kind of expense. He needs to buy the grapes, he needs to rent the facilities, and then he needs to distribute. But that winery outgrew him, and so he didn't have a place to go. So he decided he wanted to build his own winery and build and get his own vineyard. Now he's got all these capital expenses in the middle of already running a business. So then they know how to do this. So that's where they work it out with a Silicon Valley bank. And now, and those and the SVB people, you know, felt an investment in him, not just financially, but sort of emotionally. And he talks about how they would come and help with harvest, and they invite them to taste various wines. And I've heard more than one story. I know his because his has been in the news a lot. But there's more than one wine that had the same stories. But then they, you know, that investment is when they can. They show up and crush. They work the sorting tables or whatever it is. You know, you're taking out twigs and extra things like that. And it really helped in a way that you don't see, you know, in many other industries. Now, let's also, there's not a lot of other industries where people want to be as emotionally connected. You know, people love having their hands in the wine business. So there's a little bit of that going on, too.
Yeah. How significant was the wine division to Silicon Valley Bank's overall portfolio?
Well, that's fun. The funny part, it's like 2%.
Just a sliver.
Yeah, but having said that, they had like $1 billion in loans out. But, you know, so on the one hand, Silicon Valley Bank the wine division was small, but it was also a huge prestige point. And it was huge to the wine business, obviously. And, you know, it made people very, very nervous. And even though ultimately there were no financial consequences for most folks, you know, now they're nervous. They're worried about lines of credit. A lot of, you know, I've been hearing from folks who have now opened up new accounts at other banks just to have another line of credit. So there's a lot of that kind of going on. But there's another side thing, which is that because of the wine, I mean, I know that SVB is the reason for this, but there's a lot of tech buyers of high-end wines. So the small wineries in Napa and Sonoma, and maybe some of our friends in the foothills and Lodi, and certainly down the coast, these really elite wines that sell at really high levels, a lot of their customers were the tech folks who could afford it. Now, was the connection to the Silicon Valley Bank? In some cases, yes, but in some cases, no. But the failure and then the nervousness and a lot of people lost some money. That it also reduced the customer base for some of those small, really high end wineries too. So that was kind of one of those ripples that you wouldn't normally think about, but it's pretty significant.
I would just imagine in the first days following that announcement a month ago, I mean, there must have been just such a high level of uncertainty and fear and even kind of scrambling, figuring out what to do.
Yeah. And in that case, the wine business was not unique because everybody's going, can I make payroll? And remember, the assets were frozen for like 3 days. But even then, you know, if you've got a check that if you're trying to make payroll on Monday and you can't get to your money, and the wine business is a bit unique from, say, some of the tech businesses, which is that the wine business has a lot of lower income help. And those are a lot of them are folks who live paycheck to paycheck. And if somebody, you know, so now their employees are nervous about getting their money or don't know they get the money or didn't get it for a day or two, you know, there's nowhere they can go for money. So, you know, there was that ripple. Fortunately, it didn't last long. And so that was, you know, they were open by Monday, if I remember correctly. And so there was like a day or two lost, but and certainly 3 days of fear. And then, of course, lots of fear after that, where folks are still questioning, now, do I continue that investment? You know, people were in the process of maybe selling a vineyard or buying a vineyard or buying bulk wine. And now credit's gotten more expensive. I mean, this isn't just unique to the wine business, but, you know, for the folks in the wine business, they for a while there was this feeling like I'm not on solid ground and credit is getting more expensive.
Hmm. What I'm learning from you, though, it's not just that line of credit, what Silicon Valley Bank offered to their clients who are part of the wine industry. I mean, they did so much more. So what else was lost, you know, that is difficult to measure with this bank's collapse?
Well, luckily, the loss is probably going to end up being minimal. But what they offered was so unique, which is that understanding, you know. And, you know, it's get back to like the vagaries of the business. So starting is hard, growing is hard. For example, in the wine business, you know, if you are a restaurant and then you want to open a second restaurant, there's like this second layer of fixed costs that you know. You know, if you are you're making a product and you want to sell more, then, you know, you can make more and sell more. But the wine business, because of the nature of it and the nature of distribution, the nature of selling into stores, the nature of the the alcohol laws in America. We have to know them, for one. And they're different in every state and can be different in every county in some states, is that you can't just grow from, say, 5,000 cases to 7. That's a difficult leap. You almost have to double, because the added costs of having not just new people, but new supply, a new wait time to get that wine out into the market and all those things. So, you know, there's almost like tiers of growing. And that's where, as again, SVB understood the vagaries of that too. And they understood that if you were adding to your market or starting a winery, you may not have wine in your hands for 3, 4, 5 years, but you're trying to go out and sell it before you actually have it. So that's a really complicated formula.
A tricky proposal.
Yeah. And so they understood that. They understood what that cost financially. They understood that, you know, every size was different and every nature of every winery is different. So that's the thing that made everybody so nervous, was that even another bank, a community bank or a regional bank or any of those folks that even in that area, but if they really didn't understand the wine business, that it would be much more difficult or simply much more expensive to borrow money.
Yeah, I mean, and given that, you know, in the immediacy, you know, the impact ended up being minimal, you know, a month after this bank's collapse. However, you're saying that the line of credit is going up in terms of probably the interest rate. And then I'm learning from you, it can take several years before you even see any money into your investment. And then it's really difficult to grow if you want to go from a small grower to a medium to a large. So what do you think the long-term impact is going to be, like maybe 5 to 10 years from now?
Well, as you were describing that, Vicky, I'm thinking to myself, the romance of wine, right? This is the part that really people don't think about. And there's that old line that if you want to make a small fortune in the wine business, start with a large one. Well, so the long-term impact might actually not be so bad. One of them is that by all accounts, First Citizen is very committed. And they have a lot of ag business. So the wine division is probably going to get as much support, maybe even more than it had. So there's that. Second is, now there's a renewed understanding of the value of what they did. And so they may get more people contributing to the annual reports. And they've been creating these sort of indexing reports, in essence, giving people sort of status reports of where things stand in the industry, you know, quarterly and various other things. And they may get more resources for that. I suspect that, you know, people getting in the wine business will be more careful now. So, you know, it's harder anyway. And your next guest is going to explain a little bit of that. You know, the wine business expanded like mad for 2 decades in America. And it's, you know, both wine sales and the ability to do that because of the value land available and is changing. And so what it may just be is that everybody's a little more cautious, maybe growth slows, but maybe growth slows anyway. So, you know, it's hard to know. The wine business, like everyone in America, and I got to go sideways here. Taking financial advice from me is like taking medical advice from me. You really got the wrong person here. But, you know, having said all that, you know, I think that the wine business, like everyone, you know, there's still this nervousness of the banking world and what it's going to do with the American economy and whether it does or doesn't have emotional impacts. And I think that's what we're seeing right now, both in the bank world. Once again, I'm not the guy to be saying this, but certainly in the wine world, where everybody is just sort of going, okay, you know, it's like when we get to a recession, everybody keeps their money in savings, where in theory, supposed to, a society spends its way out of recession, but instead we all hold our money. And that's, I think, was what this is looking like for the wine business for a while. And then the ripples of that is 5 years out, there aren't new expanded vineyards, because the new wine that might come on the market, maybe it ends up meaning is that the larger wineries do better. You know, the Gallos and the Constellations and some of those that make brands that we all know and love, you know, that we see in the supermarkets, maybe they take a larger share of the market for the mid-priced wines. Yeah. I think the higher end guys will be the same, and the smaller end folks will be very nervous and probably won't grow.
Rick, as always, thank you.
My pleasure.
Just a great perspective. That is New York Times bestselling author and wine expert Rick Cushman explaining Silicon Valley Bank's significant role in the wine industry before its financial collapse. You're listening to Insight here on NPR station Cap Radio, and I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Over 80% of wine produced in the United States is from none other than the Golden State. When many people are asked where California wine country is located, however, typically they may point to Napa and Sonoma counties, but that ignores bountiful wine regions from the Sacramento Delta down through the Central Valley and along the Sierra foothills like Nevada, Placer, El Dorado, and Amador counties. And when it comes to the foothills, Folsom Lake College prides itself in producing the next generation of wine growers and makers. Home of the Falcons, the community college has created a viticulture and enology program, which often includes scholarships, internships from wine businesses in their backyard. But due to the pandemic, Folsom Lake College, like many colleges around the country, has struggled with a decline in enrollment. Greg McCormick is the Dean of Instruction at Folsom Lake College and joins us about the opportunities available for those interested in pursuing a career in wine. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning.
So the viticulture and enology program started about a decade ago. What prompted the idea to create a program in the wine field?
So I think there was some interest amongst faculty. We have many of our faculty from the chem department earn their advanced degrees at UC Davis, and certainly UC Davis has a reputation in the viticulture and enology field. And so with that background, there was an interest in innovating the chemistry curriculum, right? Fermentation and all that is entailed in winemaking is applied chemistry. And so that was the impetus, and certainly the geography of Folsom Lake College, and specifically our El Dorado Center, which is located near Placerville, right in the heart of El Dorado County wine region, really was fertile ground for developing a program in concert with faculty and the community.
Yeah, I mean, you really are just like in a prime location when you're in El Dorado and Amador counties, from Somerset to Fair Play, you know, going up to, people think of Apple Hill, but there's a wine region there as well, in addition to being Apple Hill. How has the program grown over the decades in terms of building partnerships and collaboration with this wine region?
So all programs at community college outside of the traditional academic paths grow incrementally. And so the curriculum was developed, the curriculum was offered, and over the course of 4 or 5 years, really grew. There was definitely industry involvement. We engage with an entity that we call our advisory board, made of industry experts who inform us on their needs and perhaps the trends that we can expect in the future, so our curriculum doesn't become stagnant. And certainly those engagements flourished pre-pandemic. Pandemic happened, things changed, and now as we're returning to a more traditional instructional modality, and the public at large is returning to a more traditional...
And you say traditional as in person.
Definitely. We did wine tasting online for a semester or two, which has some advantages. We engage people from across the state, which is great. We usually don't attract a lot of students from San Diego. But now that we're back in person, and certainly in this discipline, viticulture, enology, there's a lot of the collaborative element that is, I think, flourishes in the in-person setting.
Because there are wineries in the region that actually invest in this program, right? Because they want to benefit from the next generation of wine growers and makers.
Definitely, definitely. One of our faculty members is a full-time winemaker at Boger, and they've been a huge supporter of our program. A new winery in our region in downtown Folsom, Willamette, has been a real financial support of our program as well, because yes, they do recognize the need both for training and attracting new employees, and also for existing employees to upskill and advance their knowledge base.
Yeah, and because of the pandemic and just the struggles with student enrollment, and that is, you know, across the board at many college campuses and community colleges specifically, I mean, it seemed like there was a lot on the table in the last year or so in terms of internships and scholarships and from wine businesses in the area that were just kind of left on the table because of that student enrollment. It's not meeting its pre-pandemic levels.
Definitely. I think the population at large maybe has reassessed based on pandemic, and certainly students have as well. While Folsom Lake College is somewhat unique in that our declines in enrollment have been minimal, I think students are really evaluating options and sort of slowly returning to what we saw prior to the pandemic, and certainly that includes our viticulture program.
When it comes to the viticulture and enology program, what incentives are available for students?
So I think there are some financial incentives. We have a standing scholarship that's funded by Willamette. We have one of our faculty member who works in the industry. We have connections throughout the industry, and students as part of the curriculum step on to a number of vineyards across our region, not only in the foothills, but also in Lodi. We have some great partners down there as well. And so that opportunity to connect with folks is another big advantage, and learn from industry experts.
Yeah, and there's that community college tuition promise, right? For first-time college attendees, they get free tuition.
That's first-time, including full-time.
Including Dreamers.
Yes, first time, full time. So if you're a first time college student, and that could be directly out of high school, or it could be somebody who's been out of school for a while but has never attended college, you can, and you attend full time, which for us is defined as 12 units, then you can have all your registration and fees paid for.
When people might be thinking of, you know, of the wine industry, they may be thinking about maybe the wine tasting online classes. But I mean, the opportunities in terms of a career is so widespread. What kind of opportunities do you lead with when attracting people to this program that they may not think about when they think of the wine industry?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Our students that are enrolled in our classes span the gamut. We have folks who just want to learn more about the wine they're drinking. And then we have a smaller group, and it's the group that we're trying to encourage to recognize the opportunities, and that would be our traditional right out of high school folks. Top of their mind might not be working in a vineyard, might not be becoming a winemaker, might not be business person associated with the viticulture and enology industry, which, as your last guest spoke on broadly, that's a huge part of the wine industry, not to mention all the marketing, the sales. There's a huge swath of opportunities beyond just making of the wine. And so I think a big part of our job now is to help educate the community locally and regionally that industry does provide many opportunities for folks.
Yeah, and you offer an associate degree, but you also touched upon at the beginning of our conversation that this coursework is also transferable if they wanted to go to a four-year university like UC Davis.
Definitely. So one of the structural elements of our viticulture program is it's housed within our Department of Chemistry. And so for that reason, I think there's a lot of crossover, if you will. Analytical instrumentation is a component of our program, and that really can prepare a student to move over to UC Davis, which we don't need to spend any time talking about their reputation. It's spectacular. And so I think we serve folks who have that variety of interests, right? Some want to transfer to UC Davis and pursue this at that level. Other folks are comfortable just learning more about the bottle that they picked up at the grocery store.
Yeah, and obviously Folsom Lake College is part of the Los Rios Community College District. Are there other community colleges within the district that offer a similar viticulture program, or is Folsom Lake unique in this?
We are very unique in our district, and we're unique in the region. Not surprisingly, there's some colleges us over west of us in Napa and Santa Rosa.
Yeah, of course.
Delta has a new program as well, connected to Lodi, obviously. But in our district, right, the four colleges of Los Rios, Cosumnes, Sac City, and American River, we're the only college that has a viticulture program.
What feedback have you received over the years from wineries in the foothills about how beneficial Folsom Lake College and this program is to them? Because it's only been around for about 10 years.
Right.
And then a big part, a chunk of that includes the pandemic.
Right. A lot of enthusiasm. I sat with a group, the El Dorado Wine Association, last spring, and they were so excited to have me back. It was the first time I was there, but to have a college representative back engaging with them post-pandemic, really excited that the program was continuing and just really interested to deepen the collaboration that exists.
Yeah, because you're educating a workforce that can actually stay local, stay in Sacramento County, which, you know, Folsom's technically in Sacramento County, but you're right on the border of El Dorado County in the foothills.
Yeah. And circling back to maybe one of your previous questions, even if they're not going to see themselves as being in the wine industry, I think there's a tourism industry in the county, in the region, just those tangentially related industries, and having people in those industries with some level of knowledge about the local area and some of the major drivers economically in the area is always advantageous.
Given that there's been also this cultural shift in what people want from education over the last 3 years, I guess what are your long-term challenges that you think Folsom Lake College will need to overcome when it comes to kind of meeting the needs of a new generation of students that experience a classroom differently?
Wow. So to quote a colleague of mine, in March of 2020, the crystal ball broke, and it's tough for us. If you hold our feet to the fire right now, what do we need to do to prepare for 2025? We have some thoughts, and we have a little bit of data to inform our thinking and change, but I think with this type of program, which we generally categorize as a career education program, even though it goes well beyond just career, we need to be very responsive to the industry, to the needs of the industry, in addition to being responsive to student needs. And with a small, nimble college like Folsom, we're a little bit more able to react quickly than some of our larger counterparts.
Now, I already know it's too late for the spring semester, but what courses are going to be offered in the summer and fall months?
So viticulture and enology is set up to run 3 terms a year, so fall, spring, summer. And our offerings are set to align with the rhythms of the industry. So in summertime, we offer 2 classes. We offer our viticulture and enology program, and then we offer a wine hospitality program, which really spans the gamut of not only wine and food pairing, but into the hospitality industry as well.
That's wonderful. I mean, it seems like, I know that you can transfer to a 4-year university, but what you all offer for an associate degree, you can pretty much start a career if you have the right internships.
Definitely. I think internships are great in a large number of areas, and we definitely try and provide those opportunities to students where possible. Oftentimes, students are taking a full load of classes and have a variety of commitments that they're obligated to make, and so they may not have an opportunity to take advantage of those internships. And still, with the background and the coursework and some of the aspects of the curriculum, one of our degree requirements is forklift certification, which sounds unique. It did to me when I heard it.
It's important.
But that's a huge, huge skill and certification, frankly, to have if you're going to work at a winery. And so I think there's a lot of opportunities for students if they're strategic about their path.
Greg, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Greg McCormick is the Dean of Instruction at Folsom Lake College, sharing opportunities available for those interested in pursuing a career in wine. Still ahead, Mary Louise Kelly steps away from the host mic for All Things Considered and opens up about her new book, a memoir titled It Goes So Fast, The Year of No Do-Overs. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. How is it April already? I have had that chat with too many people to count. Frankly, I don't even know where February went. The year is just zipping by, and with it, a lot of the goals that we set for ourselves are flying along with time and perhaps unfulfilled. Mary Louise Kelly recognized how cyclical unmet intentions can be in her quite busy life as the host of NPR's All Things Considered, but more importantly, as a mom of two young boys who are quickly growing into adults. Mary Louise decided to slow down and reflect on the tough decisions she's had to make over the years, balancing quality time at home and professionally. I spoke with Mary Louise, who opened up about her new book, It Goes So Fast, The Year of No Do-Overs. Well, Mary Louise Kelly, thank you so much for taking the time. This is really, really, really a treat.
Oh, Vicki, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
So I get the first part of your title, It Goes So Fast. I think a lot of us can relate to that. But where did the year of no do-overs come from?
So the backstory there is I decided to write last year in real time. And the reason is it was the last year that the four people who live in my house were all going to be living together, guaranteed to live together under the same roof. My oldest son was heading into senior year of high school. And suddenly all the choices I'd made over the years, trying to, you know, do the juggle and be good at being a mom and attempt to be good at my job as a journalist as well, all of those choices just came into such sharp relief. And the specific example in my house was both my sons just love soccer. They always have. They have played it since the day they could walk. And my son's major focus going into senior year, as it had been for the years before, was his varsity soccer team. He's a starting forward. And his games are weekdays at 4 in the afternoon, which happens to be the time, like, the
what
worst
happens
possible
then?
Hour of the day for me, because that is the time that I go on air with All Things Considered every day. So it is impossible to anchor All Things Considered from the bleachers of a high school soccer game. And for years, I had missed them, like all of them. And I'd always told myself, next year, I'm going to figure this out. Next season, next game, somehow I'm going to get this right the next time. And suddenly you're staring down your kid's senior year, and there aren't zillions of games yet to come. There's like a number you can count on your own two hands. And I thought, okay, I'm out of next year's. I don't have any more do-overs. This is the year of no do-overs. And that became the genesis of the book. Mm.
Given that you have written two previous novels, The Bullet in 2014, followed by Anonymous Sources in 2015, clearly interviewing, reporting is totally your wheelhouse, writing fiction as well. But you're talking about opening up your life in a vulnerable way. That's an entirely different other skill set. Was it difficult to share a personal side in a memoir, or was it a little easier given that you were also behind the steering wheel?
So one challenge is just trying to figure out, this is my life. It is so personal. What is going to resonate to somebody else? You know, not everyone reading this is going to be a parent. Certainly not everyone reading this is going to be somebody with a high school senior staring down the same kind of year of no do-overs that I was. But I felt we've all probably had these moments that are inflection points in our lives where you're trying to wrestle with staying true to one thing that's really important to you, and it's in direct conflict with another thing that's really important to you, and trying to navigate that, I think, is something that resonates for all kinds of people in different ways. So all I can do is tell my story, knowing that other people's will be different, but that we're all kind of in that same boat together. I think the other thing on my mind always is, in my day job at NPR, I'm interviewing people who are in the news or who are making the news, and I'm often coming to them and asking them quite personal questions on what may be the worst day of their life, you know, the day that a hurricane came through and blew their house down, or in the case of covering Ukraine, the day that Russian tanks and troops rolled into their country. And I'm asking them questions, you know, in what I hope is a respectful way, but it is my job to help bear witness to those events and to let our audience glimpse what is happening and why it matters and what the stakes are. And as I do that, and I'm just so amazed by what people will share with us, not because they want me to know, but because they want everyone who listens to NPR to know what's happening and why it matters. I thought, why should I be immune from that? Like, why not turn some of these questions on myself and really reckon with what was on my mind in that particular year? And so that was my starting point.
Yeah. There's one particular part in your book that really resonated with me as a journalist, and that is letting the silence play out, the art of of sitting with something very uncomfortable when you're interviewing, especially in radio. It can be so difficult. When did you become so comfortable, or just comfortable, sitting with silence? Because sometimes, as you say, it could be the best part of an interview, the most revealing part and poignant part.
I don't think I ever have gotten comfortable with it. It is excruciating, as I'm sure you know, every single time when you're interviewing someone and you ask them a question and, like, right there, that silence.
It feels like hours.
It feels like an eternity. 5 seconds can feel like an eternity. And sometimes it's because somebody's thinking, let me think how I want to answer that. Or sometimes it's because you've asked them something they really don't want to answer. And the temptation, just as a human in conversation, is, let me rush in and ask a follow-up question. But if you let that silence play out and hang, it often will prompt what becomes the most interesting, most illuminating moment of that interview. And there is no way you can't lean into your radio and just be riveted listening, like, where is this going to go? So it takes some discipline to do that, but it's something that I often, you know, when younger colleagues who are coming up in our business ask me for advice, I'll tell them, let the silence hang, you know, just let it hang for a second, and or two or five or 10. Some of the most memorable interviews I have done on NPR is when I ask a question and there's that long pause, and then you really want to know what's coming next. It takes some getting used to be comfortable at doing that. And as I say, I still wrestle with it every time it happens. But I'm always grateful when I manage to keep my mouth shut and let somebody take a second before they answer.
Does the value of letting that silence play out include family life as well?
So this is another thing I continue to struggle with. But my aspiration, you know, as a mom, is to do more of that with my kids. I know probably like moms worldwide, I rush in and try to solve their problems, or I'm always nagging and prompting of, you know, why aren't you up? Why aren't, when you brushed your teeth, why aren't you dressed? Why haven't you packed? Why haven't you unpacked? Why haven't you done your multiplication tables? Now we're at the, you know, have you worked on your college essays yet? Just always the, like, let's get it done. Let's get it done. Let's get it done. And as my children have grown into young men, which they are now, I have two boys and they're teenagers, just sitting and listening to them and not trying to rush in and solve the problem, not trying to, you know, help them make their choices, but just listening to them as they grow into these amazing people in their own right, is such a pleasure. And that is as hard as it is in my day job, just to sit and listen and not interrupt, and not boss them around, but just to listen. But it's rewarding in the same way that I have found it to be in my work life.
Yeah, you really open up when it comes to parenting as a mother, as well as, you know, your husband and just your family life. But you open up also as an individual. And what I think a lot of people will find surprising is that you've had hearing loss for more than a decade. How has that shaped how you evolved as a journalist, not to mention even in your own personal life?
Yeah, you're right. A little over a decade ago, realized it. Just felt like everyone mumbled all the time. When I published my first book and did a book tour with it, I was up in front of crowds fielding questions from people, and I couldn't hear a lot of them. And I realized my day job is actually had allowed me for a long time to kind of get by, because I'm sitting talking to you right now in a soundproofed studio. There's no outside noise that's a distraction. I'm wearing professional headphones that are cranked louder than somebody else might need them, and I can hear you. But when I'm out in the world, I hadn't realized that I was hearing less and less and less and less and less. When I went to the audiologist and did the hearing tests, I realized that when I couldn't see somebody's lips move, I was missing 70% of what they said. Like, they're able to measure it. And that's a lot of the world that is passing you by. I got hearing aids. They have been life-changing. They've allowed me to continue doing this work that I love. They've allowed me to, you know, hear my teenagers as they've grown up and have these conversations with them. They don't fix everything, and I have had to ask for certain accommodations. I do my job a little bit differently than my co-anchors at NPR. And my team, my colleagues have been amazing about working with me to figure out, okay, didn't work that way. How about this? Can you hear now? And so far, we've always been able to make it work. We'll see. My hearing gets a little bit worse every year. I recently was in a hot yoga class, which I don't know if you've ever done one of these, Vicky, but yeah. I can't wear hearing aids because sweat damages them, and so I take them out, and I kind of, you know, can figure out which downward dog or sun salutation I'm supposed to be doing based on what everybody else in the class is doing, but I can't hear that much. And at the last class I went to, two women were talking and were leaving the studio together, and I was, you know, overhearing their conversation and realized I can't even tell if they're speaking English. I can't tell. I can't even recognize what language we're going with here. And that was the first time that has happened. And I put my hearing aids in, and they were chattering away in English, planning a, you know, where to go for coffee after class. But I realized this is going to keep evolving, and I guess the way that I handle it and do my job will have to keep evolving too.
Yeah, and you raise a lot of awareness as well. I was reading an interview of you talking about this, and, you know, unlike reading glasses, you know, there is a stigma when it comes to hearing loss.
Yeah, yeah. When I first got them, I was in my early 40s. And I was like, I can't need hearing aids. I'm not old. I don't want to be old. You know, there are plenty of people, my audiologist would tell you, probably pretty much everyone over the age of 40 would benefit from hearing aids. None of us hear the way we did when we were 16. We could all be a lot better about, you know, turning down our earbuds and our phones to the lowest level that you can comfortably still hear whatever it is you're trying to listen to. So I'm happy to talk about it, and I'm happy to preach preach the gospel on turning down the volume and getting your ears checked every couple of years. It can't hurt, and then you have a baseline. And I know, you know, I speak from direct personal experience. I did not realize how much I was missing. And then I got hearing aids, and I could hear a bird sing, and I could hear my footsteps when I walked down the hall, and I could hear my kids talking in the back seat of the car, and I realized I have been missing all this. I wish I'd done this years ago.
Yeah. All the seemingly little things that add so much richness to our lives.
Indeed.
Finally, before we let you go, I love that you wrote that it's an interesting exercise to think of your life as a play and that you are currently embarking on Act 3. The reason why you wrote this memoir was because your oldest son was, you know, embarking or moving on to what is a first chapter in adult life. How does home life feel now?
So he's off. He's in college. This is the way it's supposed to happen, is he did finish high school and he is a freshman at the University of Chicago and loves it, is super happy. But the house is a lot quieter now. I come home and some nights, you know, it's me and the Bernedoodle hanging out in the kitchen. And I walk past my oldest son's bedroom and it's bizarrely neat, quiet, organized. This is not a neat, quiet, or organized child. And you feel your heart going in two directions, just so swollen with love that he's happy and out there and thriving and doing, you know, what you hope your kid will grow up and do. And also just missing him in a way that I hadn't imagined.
Mary Louise Kelly, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Vicky, thank you.
Mary Louise Kelly is the host of NPR's All Things Considered, talking to us about her new book, It Goes So Fast, The Year of No Do-Overs. It's a memoir about her life and family in the last year they all lived under one roof before her eldest son graduated and moved away to college. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.